is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi leads her political party to a sweeping victory in landmark elections in Myanmar. The U.S. Justice Department says it will take the fight about Obama's executive actions on immigration all the way to the Supreme Court. And it's been 20 years since the then-military-led government in Nigeria executed the Ogoni Nine, including leader Ken Sarawiwa. We look at what has and hasn't changed in the region. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The Supreme Court may decide the fate of some 5 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States in mixed-status families. Obama administration officials announced this week that they will appeal a federal court ruling that continues to block the president's executive actions on immigration. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports from Los Angeles.
The U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled late Monday to uphold a lower court's decision to block President Barack Obama's executive actions that would have made it easier for some 5 million undocumented immigrants to live and work in the United States. The executive actions came after Congress failed to pass immigration reform after years of wrangling. The attorneys general of 26 Republican-ruled states filed suit, arguing the president overstepped his authority. So far, a federal judge in Brownsville, Texas, and a circuit court in New Orleans have sided with the states. On Tuesday, White House spokesperson Josh Earnest said the administration will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The impact of Republican opposition, both to these executive actions and to broader comprehensive immigration reform legislation, is to only perpetuate a system in which our law enforcement resources are diffused, and it results in more families being torn apart. And that is clearly not in the best interests of our national security. It's not in the best interests of public safety. It's also not consistent with the values of this country.
The president's executive actions on immigration, announced last November, would grant temporary legal status to undocumented parents of U.S. citizens or legal residents through a program known as DAPA, or Deferred Action for Parents of Americans. Another measure would expand DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. DACA originally took effect via executive action in 2012. The program provides deportation relief to young immigrants who meet a series of stringent requirements. The Obama administration points to DACA as a successful way of bringing otherwise law-abiding immigrants out of the shadows. Opponents of the program say it amounts to amnesty for people who came to the United States outside of legal channels. Saffron Killio from the UCLA Dream Resource Center says while the Fifth Circuit's ruling is disappointing, it is not surprising.
So it's definitely something that's not unexpected, although, you know, it just highlights how frustrating it continues to be for the immigrant community, you know, while these decisions are going around and these policies are, you know, being talked about in the national level, the deportation of family members is still going on.
Despite presidential support for DACA and DAPA, the administration has also deported record numbers of undocumented immigrants. Republican presidential candidates are pledging to step up deportations even more, but without providing a legal path for mixed-status families to remain united. It's now up to the justices of the Supreme Court to decide whether or not to hear the case before the clock runs out on Obama's time in the White House. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act reveal that for at least a decade, the FBI actively monitored an annual nonviolent vigil outside of the military base at Fort Benning, Georgia. The yearly action, organized by School of the Americas Watch, protests a military training academy currently known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The academy, formerly called the School of the Americas, trains military personnel and police from various Latin American countries. Among the graduates are figures accused of massive human rights violations in the Americas, including former military dictators like Efrain Rios Montt of Guatemala, Manuel Noriega of Panama, Argentine junta members, and many other lesser-known military commanders. The annual vigil at Fort Benning marks the anniversary of the 1989 massacre of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter in El Salvador by members of a counterinsurgency battalion formed at the School of the Americas. The newly released FBI documents even note that the protests are always peaceful, but that didn't deter the Bureau's counterterrorism division from closely monitoring the yearly event. Joining me to discuss the FBI files is Hendrik Voss of School of the Americas Watch. Your organization has received more than 420 pages covering a decade spanning from 2000 to 2010. What are some of the highlights?
Yeah, it was really interesting to see those documents. We requested them through the Partnership of Civil Justice, attorney group here in Washington, D.C., that works for social justice. And when we looked through the 429 pages, what we saw was that the FBI was using its counterterrorism division to spy on School of the Americas Watch, and also that they used actually infiltrators who came to the protest, who infiltrated SOA Watch to get information. And even so, in each of their reports, they said that SOA Watch is a nonviolent, peaceful organization, and that there were really no reasons for spying on SOA Watch. They still kept coming back year after year with the excuse that they said, oh, maybe there might be some violent elements that might join the protest. But yeah, with this line of argumentation, you could, yeah, spy on everything and violate everybody's constitutional rights.
Why did SOA Watch initiate this FOIA request, and how long has it taken to get the documents?
We asked for the documents back in 2010. In 2010, there was an incident where when people were leaving the vigil site, that the local police force in Columbus started to arrest people. And we really wanted to know who was behind that, what was the decision-making process on part of the police in Columbus. So at that point, we were asking for files from military intelligence, from the Columbus PD, from the Muskogee County Sheriff's Department, as well as from the FBI. The files that were just now released came from the Atlanta field office of the FBI, and it shows very much the communication that has been going on between all these different agencies. But it also shows that there is a lot that we do not know, because a lot of the pages have been redacted and other documents, they refuse to hand them over. But together with our friends from the Partnership for Civil Justice, we will go after that and also to try to get all the documents that they have on School of the Americas Watch.
This comes on the eve of the School of the Americas Watch annual vigil, scheduled for next weekend. What are you planning this year?
This year we will go, the movement is mobilizing to go to the Stewart Detention Center, which is the largest adult immigrant prison in the United States. And we are going there because we also want to show the connection between militarism and migration, because we see the School of the Americas violence and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America as one of the root causes of migration. And when people come here to the United States, they are then faced with racist immigration laws, and people are being locked up in places like the Stewart Detention Center. So we will go there on Saturday morning to call attention to that. On Saturday afternoon, we will go back to Columbus, Georgia, for a day-long conference, concerts, workshops, plenaries, strategy sessions to really delve into the issues. And then on Sunday morning, we will return to the gates of Fort Benning, and we will hear from speakers, musicians, and then we have a solemn funeral procession that is marching to the gates of Fort Benning to change the fence that is leading on the street that is leading to the School of the Americas, that we morph it into a big memorial for everybody who has been killed by the graduates of the school.
That's Hendrik Voss of the School of the Americas Watch. The annual convergence will take place November 20th through the 22nd near Columbus, Georgia. You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. Two major scientific reports out this week look at the effects of climate change on water currently stored in the global freezer. First, two major glaciers on Greenland's once stable northeast coast are rapidly deteriorating, with one now losing mass at a rate of 5 billion tons a year. That's according to a study published Thursday in the journal Science based on four decades of data. A second study published this week in the scientific journal Environmental Research Letters looks at snowpacks that feed water basins around the world. As more winter precipitation falls as rain, permanent snowpacks shrink, and these mountaintop reservoirs decline and could critically reduce freshwater supplies to an estimated 2 billion people globally. Justin Mankin is a postdoctoral research scientist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies at Columbia University. He's also the lead author of the new study, The Potential for Snow to Supply Human Water Demand in the Present and Future.
The wonderful thing about snowpack is that it provides its own form of kind of water infrastructure, serving as both its reservoir and water source. Melting over spring and summer months, which is precisely concurrent when both human water demands and ecosystem water demands tend to increase in spring and summer. And so, but the implications of that snow change, the fact that there will be reduced snowpack, that's going to vary from place to place, and in particular the implications for people, that's going to be a function of the role that snow presently plays in the water supply portfolios.
Mankin says the study identified 32 water basins that depend on snowpacks to supply fresh water to large numbers of people around the world. In many, there's above a 90% risk of a decline in water availability. In Myanmar, the National League for Democracy, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, swept to an historic win in parliamentary elections held last Sunday. The vote tally continues, but with more than 80% of the ballots counted, election officials say the NLD has secured an absolute majority, and outgoing President Thein Sein sent his congratulations to democracy icon Suu Kyi. The polls tested the democratic reform process in the country also known as Burma, which began in 2010 when Aung San Suu Kyi was released from nearly 20 years of house arrest. It was while confined that she won the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize for standing up for democracy and human rights in the face of Myanmar's brutal military dictatorship. A darling of both the Burmese people and the international community, in recent years, Aung San Suu Kyi's image has tarnished by what many call her failure to speak out on an issue of human rights, the persecution of Myanmar's Rohingya minority. FSRN's Patricia Noonan brings us a closer look.
It's hard to encapsulate the impact Aung San Suu Kyi has had on Myanmar. She's the daughter of the man many called Burma's founding father, Aung San, who was assassinated in 1947, shortly before the country won independence. She's the academic turned activist, whose party, the National League for Democracy, won 1990 elections by a landslide, only to see Myanmar's military leaders nullify the results and place Suu Kyi under house arrest. She's the Nobel laureate who at any point during her close to 20 years in house arrest would have been allowed to leave Myanmar to live in exile, but refused to do so. But now she's becoming known as a leader who has refused to act in the face of what some are calling genocide. It used to be so dangerous to say Aung San Suu Kyi's name during the decades of military dictatorship, many referred to her simply as the lady. But now, to many, she's conspicuous by her near silence on the issue of violence against ethnic Rohingya.
That is very sad. The lady, she has been talking about the rule of law the whole life, you know, as an activist. Unfortunately, she hasn't done anything against the atrocities going on against the Rohingya and the Muslim.
Khin Maung Myint is the vice president of Myanmar's National Democratic Party for Development. He charges that Suu Kyi is kept quiet in the face of genocide just to win votes. In 2012, a Buddhist extremist launched a campaign of violence against ethnic Rohingya. They say the dark-skinned and Muslim Rohingya are Bangladeshi and not a part of any of the official ethnic groups recognized by Myanmar law. Scores of Rohingya were killed while tens of thousands of others were forced into internment camps in northern Rakhine State, where many still languish today. Conditions are so bleak that since 2012, up to 120,000 have tried to leave Myanmar by boat, often falling prey to people smugglers. At least 8,000 have died at sea, according to the United Nations.
The lady tried to keep quiet herself and not taking any side. She always said in her interview, she said, oh, if I talk about one group, the other group will misunderstand me or accuse me of taking side. Actually, that's not the way it should be. You have right to, you have courage to say what is right and what is wrong. But she was very much after, she is still very much after the votes of the majority of Buddhist people.
The genocide question is a contentious one. It requires that one prove intent on the part of one group to destroy another. But according to the human rights group Fortify Rights, the evidence is there, and they're calling on the United Nations Human Rights Council to launch an investigation. Tasmin Mottola is from Yale Law School's Allard K. Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic. She contributed to the group's legal analysis on the Rohingya situation.
So examining the case law and examining the facts ahead of in front of us, we found persuasive evidence that the intent element of genocide was present.
When the question of genocide against the Rohingya was put directly to her at a recent press conference, Suu Kyi dismissed it.
All those who have goodwill towards this country should remember that there's a Burmese saying, you have to make big problems small and small problems disappear. It's not a question of trying to exaggerate small problems into big ones and big ones into an extent where they are totally unmanageable. I'm not saying that this is a small problem. I would promise everybody who is living in this country proper protection in accordance with the law and in accordance with the norms of human rights.
The debate about Suu Kyi and the Rohingya is causing genuine confusion among her admirers and concern among observers, both local and international. Some speculate that Suu Kyi is playing the long game. If she wins power from the military with this week's parliamentary election, they say, she's going to fix a lot of things, including the Rohingya issue. Others dismiss that idea. Brad Adams is the Asia director of Human Rights Watch.
Well, it's impossible to know what's inside Aung San Suu Kyi's brain, but she has shown no sympathy and no concern for the Rohingya. She's at most said that the answer to this problem, which is ethnic cleansing, according to Human Rights Watch, genocide, according to other people, is for there to be the rule of law. But when asked what that means practically and how that's going to protect anyone, she has no answer. It's just a mantra. It's empty rhetoric. I mean, being in favor of the rule of law is like being in favor of motherhood. It means nothing.
For the time being, Myanmar and the population of roughly 1 million Rohingya are only facing more uncertainty. Only after 6 months of political horse trading will Myanmar's government start to enact a new agenda. For now, it seems the Rohingya and the question of genocide are not likely to be on it. Patricia Noonan, FSRN, Yangon.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. Hundreds of indigenous Lumads have marched from Mindanao in the southern Philippines to Manila to call attention to a spate of recent attacks and killings targeting their members. The weeks-long walk started on October 26th and has included several pauses for protest along the way. They plan to draw international attention to their issues when Manila hosts the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit of regional leaders next week. Robert Packard reads for Madonna Varola in Quezon City.
In one of the stops in their walk from Mindanao to Manila, hundreds of indigenous Lumads and their supporters camped for 1 week at the grounds of the University of the Philippines. They want to draw attention to violent land grabs within their traditional territory and call on the authorities to investigate and punish recent killings of Lumad land defenders. Among the dead is Lumad leader Dionel Campos. He was killed on September 1st in a tribal school in the Lianga Surigao del Norte village in the southern Philippines. His daughter, Michelle Campos, believes paramilitaries known as the Mahagat Bagani are responsible.
It was dawn when a group of armed men knocked hard on the doors, threatening to gun people down if they didn't gather in the basketball court. My three younger sisters saw the paramilitary forces shoot my father in the head. The children were terrified. They threatened to massacre people if they didn't leave the area.
Michelle Campos said her father was actively opposing the incursion of mining interests into their ancestral lands. Activists have documented 5 massacres targeting Lumads during the present administration. The violence has displaced thousands more from their territory. Ariel Casilao is among the leaders of the activist group Anak Pais from Mindanao, who has been traveling with the march.
The Aquino regime is implementing a counterinsurgency operational plan named before the U.S. counterinsurgency methodology, which is Oplan Bayanihan. The problem is wherein people, groups, or organizations that are critical to this government protesting large-scale intrusion to their ancestral lands because of large-scale foreign projects like mining, logging, agri-corporations, plantations. People are protesting and they are being vilified, they are being tagged as communists or as fronts or members, sympathizers of the revolutionary group New People's Army.
He said Lumad schools in particular have been the targets of multiple attacks. He adds Lumad supporters have been facing trumped-up charges and surveillance, including himself. The Armed Forces Chief of Staff, General Hernando Iriberi, denied military involvement in the Lumad killings and challenged accusers to produce evidence. Catholic priest and anthropologist Albert Alejo in Davao says indigenous land defenders face violence from multiple armed actors.
Indigenous peoples in Mindanao are killed sometimes by the military and at other times by the armed rebel groups called the New People's Army. There are also indigenous peoples killed by some guards of mining companies. There are also indigenous groups killed by the private armies of local politicians. And so this is a very complicated situation.
But, Alejo points out, violence against Lumads is rarely investigated or prosecuted, meaning that perpetrators can expect to be able to operate with impunity. UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Victoria Tolikorpas has urged action on stalled peace talks between the government, the New People's Army, and the National Democratic Front, different sides of an armed conflict in an area that includes the Lumad's ancestral territory.
I would strongly recommend that a mechanism where a joint monitoring and investigation could happen, and then people, and then the facts, so that the facts will really come out, and based on those facts, then there will be a subsequent discussions on how to deal with that kind of situation.
Back at the people's camp, Michelle Campos says life is more difficult without her father, but she will complete her studies, stand up for her family, and demand justice for her father and her community.
This is what my father wants. Education is important. It gives honor to us Lumads. It is sacred. It teaches us our rights, why we should protect our ancestral land, not to be discriminated, and to progress as a people.
The Lumads are camping at the Liwasong Bonifacio Plaza in Manila, ahead of next week's APEC summit. They say, if pushed away, they will continue their protest for international guests to see. Reading for FSRN's Madonna Varola in Quezon City, I'm Robert Packard.
This week marked 20 years since the then military-led government of Nigeria executed playwright and minority rights activist Ken Sarawiwa, along with 8 others. The men, all environmental campaigners opposed to the activities of the multinational oil company Shell in indigenous Ogoni territory, were hanged after a trial that drew international criticism. Sam Olokoya examines what has happened in the Ogoni lands in the 2 decades since.
The Ogoni sing a popular song composed in honor of Ken Sarawiwa and the 8 other environmental campaigners executed with him. A military tribunal convicted the men of murder in what was regarded worldwide as a sham trial. Their real crime was organized nonviolent opposition to the activities of the Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell and the military-led government. The Ogonis regard Sarawiwa as their Nelson Mandela. He led the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people, MOSOP, which drew attention to the environmental effects of gas flares and oil pollution affecting rivers and farmlands in the Niger Delta region. 20 years after the execution of the 9 activists, Celestian Akpobiri says widespread pollution continues to impact public health.
The huge toll of a polluted environment is taking its bite on the people, because people are dying. Life has become so short. You will see posters, burial posters, you will think it's an election. So poverty, hunger has taken their seat in Ogoni. The only thing that is alive is the resilience of the people to fight on.
The Sarurua-led struggle forced the Nigerian government to allow the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, to carry out an assessment of the environment in Ogoni land. The UN body found that oil extraction and related activities have caused grave environmental harm. Drinking water from wells were contaminated by cancer-causing agents at over 900 times above limits set by the World Health Organization. The Ogoni people feel the impact of pollution in other ways. Barele is a little village in the heart of Ogoni land, accessible only by a narrow dirt road. Most people here are subsistence farmers. Community member John Aseme says local residents are still coping with the after effects of an oil spill which flowed into the village years ago.
The oil entered inside my house, and all our clothes and all everything were damaged by the spill. And I was packed out from my house because there was oil inside my house. Up till now, we are suffering. All my property, all my house is damaged.
The portion of the community farmland where the oil pipeline ruptured and sparked a fire remains a wasteland. Throughout Ogoni land, oil pollution has profoundly affected the traditional occupation of farming and fishing. But when Ogoni leaders like Sarurua took their grievances to the military-led government, the official response was to deploy soldiers to the region to violently put down their agitation. The military destroyed several Ogoni villages with explosives. The Mossop says soldiers killed hundreds of villagers.
Great Ogoni people!
Great!
Great Ogoni people!
Great!
The Ogoni anthem, composed in the heat of their struggle against Shell, calls on Ogonis to resist oppression and exploitation. Mossop member Comfort Tombari says the people cannot afford to fail the executed men who sacrificed their lives for the struggle.
They laid down their lives, so they have paid the price for us to live. They paid the price. It's just like his. So we that have been left behind must continue. This is my land. There is nowhere I will run to and stay, leaving my own land for another person to take over. No.
20 years after the execution drew worldwide attention to the Ogoni struggle, the community continues to pressure the Nigerian government to clean up the lingering pollution in line with the recommendations of the UNEP report. Shell no longer drill in Ogoni land, but pipelines do run through the territory and spills continue to occur. The government vows it will soon begin the first phase of the cleanup at a cost of about $1 billion. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
And that does it for this week's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is French Collective via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.